2 Peter 2, verses 4 through 10a, the seventh talk in a series on the book of 2 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 5, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're continuing in our study in 2 Peter. Last week, Michael asked a good question about whether Peter was speaking about the future or the present. And I want to start by giving a more complete answer to that question, and I'll use this as an introduction to set up what we're going to talk about today. As you may notice, if you've been looking at 2 Peter, Peter uses the future tense in a number of important places throughout the letter. For example, in the passage we looked at last week, he said, "There will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive factions." So I've been saying that Peter is writing this letter with the problem of the false teachers in mind. But is that a current problem, which is kind of what I've been suggesting, or is he just saying that in the future this problem might happen? To tell you how I think about that, let's think for a minute about the different kinds of letters that we see in the New Testament in regard to this kind of issue. For example, we have Paul writing two letters to the Corinthians. We have two letters that he wrote in the New Testament. These were very personal letters in the sense that they were aimed at people he knew well. Paul founded the church in Corinth. He lived there for over a year. Afterwards, the Corinthians wrote him letters with specific questions that he was responding to. He had gone back to visit them. He knows the situation there very well. He knows the people there very well, and his letters reflect that. He speaks to very specific problems, sometimes problems that they have even written him and asked him to address, and sometimes he names names. Now, when Paul wrote his letter to the Romans, we're backed off a little bit from that. He did not found the church in Rome. He knew some of the people there. He knew the situation that they were going to be facing, and so he wrote a more generalized letter to them, being aware that the issue of dealing with the Jewish objections to the gospel and things like that, in his experience, he knew this is the kind of thing that you're going to be facing, and so he spoke to it. He does mention some specific names at the end of the letter, but he doesn't seem to be responding to a particular problem that is happening right that moment so much as he is preparing them to deal with something that might be coming. When we look at something like the book of James, James is a letter that seems quite different. It doesn't have any personal touches to it, and it seems to be going out to churches in a fairly large region. James is aware of general sorts of problems that many of the churches are facing, I would say, so that what he says is relevant to their situation, but he's not speaking to any particular person or problem, I think. Well, I think that's the kind of letter that we have in 2 Peter. To me, it has a similar feel to James. I would guess that Peter expects this letter to be passed around the region of Asia Minor. He's not speaking to a particular issue in one church, it doesn't seem like, as we look at it, but is aware of general problems faced by the churches in that area. And then furthermore, as we saw earlier, Peter makes it explicit that he's writing a kind of a legacy letter. He believes that he's going to die soon, and he wants to write something that will encourage them now in what they're facing, but also in the future when he's gone. So I think Peter is writing a general letter with an eye to the future. And so when he says that certain things will happen, he's not saying these things aren't happening now, but they will later. I don't think he's making predictions like a prophet saying, I can see that it may not be a problem now, but certain things are going to happen. I think he's speaking to the general kinds of problems that he knows the churches are facing. Some of his statements seem more immediate, that he's speaking to things that he is aware of. But in fact, they are the kinds of problems that churches always face and always will face. I would say from Peter's perspective, it's a very fundamental kind of issue he's dealing with. There are only two roads we can be on, the road to judgment and destruction or the road to mercy and life. That's the choice. And which road we are on depends in the larger sense on whether God has chosen us, as Peter talks about, but God's choice of us makes itself known in the choices that we make. Faith is something that must be embraced and lived out. We must choose to abandon rebellion against God. We must choose to believe his promises and pursue the life and godliness that he has promised. So, from Peter's perspective then, if this is the situation, what's the worst thing that we can encounter in this life? Anything that lies to us about God. Anything that persuades us to ignore God rather than pursue him. And of all of those lying, seductive forces that we come across in the world, some of the worst are what Jesus before had called wolves in sheep's clothing. Those who present themselves as followers of God and yet in fact would seduce us away from the truth. That's one of the most serious situations that we can find ourselves in, where something that claims to be speaking for God is in fact steering us in another direction. So this is, I think, the situation that Peter is addressing and what he's trying to speak to in his letter. He is urging his readers to personally embrace the gospel, and he's warning them not to be seduced by so-called believers whose lives are a model of rebellion, not faith. I think the evidence suggests that they are dealing with such false teachers at the time Peter writes, and Peter knows that after he is gone, they will continue to face these issues because this is what always happens. So I think Peter says these things will happen kind of in the sense that we might say boys will be boys. We say it in response to a present situation. A boy, a particular boy, does something, and we say boys will be boys. But we are also acknowledging in this particular situation that this is the way it tends to happen. And I think that's what he's doing in the letter. So it has both a present application to their situation, but also a general looking ahead. This is the sort of thing that you need to look out for. So last week, we started to look at a long sentence that began in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. And we looked at some other things too, but we started to look at this sentence. And I mentioned the puzzling nature of verse 4. We're not going to go over that again today, but this is where the question arises, is Peter drawing on material from outside the Old Testament, in particular a book called 1 Enoch, which is not in the Old Testament? Does he believe that 1 Enoch is telling a true story and that's why he's quoting it? I'm not going to go into all of that again, but that's the part that we looked at last time. Now what I want to do is look at the overall sentence and see what his point is. I think his point is clear enough. Whether he's using 1 Enoch and exactly what he thinks about 1 Enoch, those are complicated questions, and I don't have any more to say about that today. But I think the point that he wants to make is clear enough, and that's what we want to talk about today. Let me remind you what came just before 2:4. That was 2:3. And what 2:3 says is, he says that the judgment of the false teachers is not idle and their destruction is not asleep. That is, the situation is that although in this life it might seem that the false teachers are prospering, and in fact, very often there's great reward in being in that situation, and you can get yourself a number of cushy deals in this life by pursuing that road, but God has his eye on them, and he knows where ultimately they're going to end up. Their judgment is not asleep. God has destined them for judgment and destruction, basically. So this long sentence then elaborates on that theme, the idea that judgment is certain, ultimately. And in this sentence, Peter reaches back into history to talk about how God has dealt with us in the past. So starting in 2:4, 2 Peter, For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, and if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of lawless men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly out of trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its defiling desires and despise authority. Okay, so I don't know what your experience is. When I first became a Christian, and I don't know that it's really changed over time, it was very much looked down upon to be a fire and brimstone preacher. Fire and brimstone preaching was not cool. I was sitting here thinking about, why is that? I mean, what exactly is it that I felt was being communicated? And I don't know, there are several things. I think, in part, people felt that it was bad PR for God, that it was better to talk about God's love because people would respond to a message of God's love, but a message about God's judgment puts people off. I mean, why would I want to deal with a God like that? I think that was part of it. Part of it was a certain embarrassment with a certain model of the kind of earnest, somewhat naive preacher who's pounding the pulpit and saying you're going to go to hell if you don't, you know, believe in Jesus, that we were just embarrassed by that person, and we wanted to indicate to the world that we weren't uncool like that person. You know, we had sensitivity, we understood your feelings, and we're not, you know, talking on and on about hell and stuff like that all the time. I don't know, and there are probably other things as well, a desire not to be perceived as judgmental by other people, I don't know. But definitely, I came into the Christian world getting the message, fire and brimstone preaching is not cool. Well, I think that what we just read here qualifies as fire and brimstone preaching, from the way I would understand what we're talking about. He is talking about judgment and those who will enter into judgment and those who will escape judgment. And in fact, he talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, which is where we even get the phrase fire and brimstone anyway. When Jesus talks about it, it's the fire and brimstone comes down from heaven. So this is serious and harsh stuff. And it's only going to get more harsh as we go on in the chapter. But clearly, Peter thinks this is very important. This is the letter he wants to write, remember, before he dies. He wants to leave this with people so that they can be reminded of what is of central importance. And this is part of that message. So we need to take this on. We need to try to see, you know, what's behind this harsh language. Can we embrace it? I hope we can embrace it because, as I've said, I think this is Peter, the apostle, writing, and his perspective on this stuff we need to embrace. Here's where I think he's coming from. This is what I think is motivating what we're going to see here. One of the fundamental problems of human beings, unbelievers and believers alike, is that we are short-sighted. It's like we've got the blinders on. You know, we're looking right at what's in front of us, at the particular problems that we have in this life, the particular goals that we have, the particular solutions to our problems that we think that we can work out right now, and so on. And because of that, we tend to lose sight of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture that I'm talking about is the bigger picture that God is responsible for. This is God's world. I don't just exist because I have a right to exist, and here I am in this world, and the world owes me a living, and the world owes me to make me happy as I would like to be. I exist because the creator of the universe decided there was going to be a me, and he decided where he was going to put me and what he was going to do with me. So I am in the midst of a world that is a part of the very big purposes of God. And to have the big picture is to recognize the God who is behind all of this, and how do I relate to him? What difference does it make that this is his world and he has certain purposes? So I would say that all of the biblical authors bring this sort of thing up all the time. The idea that the truly wise person uses the Bible as a window on the past and the future. I've got my eyes right set on the present, but the scriptures and the wisdom that the scriptures give have to do with giving me a window on what has come before me, what has God done in the past, and where is this going? What has he promised to do in the future? And the reason for this is because the truly wise person needs to deal with reality. And reality is not just this little slice of stuff that's in front of my eyes right now. Reality is the reality that God is creating. And he has told us what he's doing, why he's doing it, and where it's going. So I can't really be a wise person if I'm not taking into account what it is God did in the past and where he has said he has is taking this thing. That's the perspective from which Peter is coming. He often in this letter is urging us to remind ourselves of what God has said about what happened and what he's going to do. And that's kind of central to his purpose. And I think that's what motivates Peter in our passage today. As harsh as it might sound, he is basically trying to give us the big picture. Let's not be short-sighted. Let's look in the past to see how God has dealt with us in the past, because God doesn't change, and how he dealt with rebellion in the past is a model of how he's going to deal with it in the future. So that's why he's saying this stuff. I mean, I don't see Peter as trying to come off as somehow better than anybody else, or let me stand on my soapbox and condemn you or anything like that. He's saying, look, this is how it's always been. Let me tell you how it's always been. So in this sentence that I just read, a long sentence because he looks at several examples in the same sentence, he shows three examples of God's judgment. The judgment of the angels, which we talked about last time, a little bit anyway, the judgment of the ancient world by means of a flood in the time of Noah, and the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he draws two conclusions from these three examples. One of his conclusions sounds a note of encouragement, and one sounds a note of warning. That conclusion is found in verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation or from trial, and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. So let's talk first about that second part. This is the judgment part, the note of warning. The Lord knows how to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. Notice that there is an element of waiting here, and I think it's deliberate. There is a day of judgment coming. The judgment, the ultimate judgment, has not been pronounced yet. But Peter is suggesting that God is keeping them. I kind of picture him, he's got his hand on them and says, I got you right here. The day of judgment is coming, and I have got you ready for it. It will, when it comes, you will not have escaped. Well, This element of waiting fits exactly with what Peter said just before in verse 3. The judgment of the false teachers is not asleep, is not idle. Again, he's saying it may not be here now. It may not look like there's any cost to what they are pursuing, but it's coming. It's not asleep. And ultimately, God is going to do what he always does. And so in the stories that he's looking at here, he's reminding us, this is what God always does. This is how God responds to rebellion. And Peter sees this pattern of a judgment that is surely coming in the three stories that he tells. Explicitly in the story of the angels are kept under darkness, reserved for the day of judgment. So they're exactly that picture. There is a day of judgment coming for them that has not arrived yet, but when the day comes, then their final destruction will be complete. The other two stories are not about the final day of judgment, but they give us a model to think about how God deals with rebellion. These two stories are about historical judgments that God brought on people in this age. He brought death upon people who had rebelled against him. But these stories also have, I think, strong implications that speak to our situation of a judgment that is sleeping, that until the judgment comes, it seems like everything is going along perfectly fine. In fact, that's what Jesus says in Luke 17:26. He speaks about the same two stories. He talks about the flood, and he talks about Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is what he says. "And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it shall be also in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were being given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed." And it is a little interesting to me that in the way Jesus tells that story, he does not neglect to include, which is not part of his main point, but he does not neglect to include the positive side of it. Noah entered into the ark. Lot left Sodom. There's the picture of the person of God who has been preserved from the judgment along with the picture of the judgment. But what Jesus is emphasizing this idea is, until it happens, it just seems like everything's just going along normal. You would think that today is going to be just like tomorrow, but unfortunately today is the day when the flood comes and everybody is wiped out, or the fire and brimstone comes down from heaven and Sodom and Gomorrah are no more. So notice, Jesus uses the same examples as Peter, Noah, and Lot. Well, this is what Peter wants, I think. I think it's a very similar idea to what Jesus says. He wants his readers to recognize the situation, to wake up. No matter how things may seem to be going on as usual, in the end, God's judgment comes. This is one of the lessons of the past that the scriptures show us. That's what we see in the story of the flood, in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. There comes a point at which God will deal with rebellion against him. But there is this other encouraging flip side to this lesson as well. The past also shows us God's faithfulness to his people. In verse 9, Peter draws the conclusion from what he just said, "The Lord knows how to rescue the godly out of trials," or something like that. We'll talk about this. So here's a picture of God rescuing his people. The judgment does not come on Noah and his family. It does not come on Lot. Now, your translation may say there, "rescue the godly from temptation." That's not exactly wrong. It's okay as a translation, but I don't think it quite captures what is at stake here. This word, which can be translated temptation or trial, is often used in contexts that are talking about the sort of trial which is a test of what sort of person are you? Are you with God or not? So I've often talked about here about how much the New Testament talks about the testing of our faith, that God puts us in certain situations where we are called upon to actually act on and choose to live in a certain way based on the fact that we really believe the gospel. And this is something that God has been doing with his people all along, is that the circumstances of life sort us out as to what we're about. So I think that's what's under view in this situation. He's not making a general statement, God preserves us from temptation, as if it's some sort of a promise that anytime I'm tempted to do something wrong, that God will keep me from doing it. It's not that kind of a statement that he's making. Remember the stories that he's drawing this conclusion from. Look at what happened. the whole world was destroyed, but Noah wasn't. Sodom and Gomorrah were consumed, but Lot wasn't. He's not just saying they did not, he rescues them from judgment. I mean, that's true enough. But he's saying he rescues them from trial. And I think what he's getting at is that, for example, in Noah's time, you could say the whole world was under trial and failing the test. You looked at humanity, and in one mass, it was hostile and rebellious to God. But Noah was a righteous man. Here he is, a godly person, a person who has put his trust in God, living in a world where every one of his neighbors was hostile to God. Not just most of them, but all of them were hostile to the God that he was following. Why didn't he go that way? I mean, why didn't he succumb to the pressure that must have been there in a culture like that? I mean, a universally hostile to God culture. Well, I would say it is because God didn't just rescue him from the coming flood. He rescued him in the midst of this trial. That is, he preserved him in his faithfulness so that he did not come under the judgment. Why was Noah rescued? Why is it that he was on the ark and nobody else was? Because God had taken him through the trial, and Noah had emerged as a person of righteousness and faithfulness. Not a person who was not a sinner. He was a sinner. Remember about, I think it's Noah who ends up passed out drunk and naked in his tent. You know, this is a man with faults, but he was a righteous man in the sense that he believed in God and trusted in God and was trying to pursue what God wanted him to pursue. So he was righteous in the sense that he was faithful in following God. Now this theme, this idea that God preserved him, not just rescued him because he was faithful, but actually preserved him in his faithfulness, rescued him through this trial, I think fits very well with other things that Peter has been saying. Peter has been talking about God choosing us. He's been talking about the result of the gospel in our lives being the impartation of God's nature and character to us and so forth. This is God acting on us. So Peter very much believes that God is the one who is working this in us. But at the same time, how does that work itself out? How does God's choosing me work itself out? It works itself out by me choosing to trust him and follow him. So he can rightly at the same time say God rescues the righteous in the midst of these trials. He preserves them in the midst of these trials, I think is what he's getting at. And yet he can urge us then to choose to follow God, because that's how God's choosing of us ultimately works itself out. The other story, the story of Lot, is an interesting one. Our good friend Tony has always said that Lot is his hero, his favorite character in the Bible, because, well, let me tell you the story here if you don't remember. Remember that Lot is Abraham's nephew, and he's living in Sodom and Gomorrah, or probably one of those. And God, in the form of angels, comes to Abraham and says, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Abraham bargains with God. Says, okay, so, you know, what if there were like 50 righteous people there? You wouldn't destroy, I mean, you know, you don't destroy the righteous along with the wicked, do you? So that wouldn't be fair. So if there were 50 righteous people there, you wouldn't wipe them out, would you? And God says, okay, I won't if there's 50. And then Abraham starts negotiating with him, and he gets him down to 10. He says, if there's 10 righteous people in the town, I will not wipe it out. Well, of course, you're aware of how it turns out. He wipes out Sodom and Gomorrah, so there must not have been 10 when he got there. I would say that as the way we're supposed to understand the story is that there was one, and that was Lot. We're not told a lot about Lot. I didn't do that on purpose. I would not descend to doing that on purpose. I think it's the story itself that tells us that Lot is a good guy. Now, there is a spot after the account where it says that God rescued Lot for Abraham's sake. And you could argue that he only took Lot out, not for anything in Lot, but just for the sake of Abraham, because Lot was his nephew. But I don't think the story reads that way. I think we're meant to see Lot as one of the faithful because of the way it goes down when he gets there. Lot is at the gate. The angels come, and he invites them to his home. It's not clear. It's possible that he invites them to his home because he knows the kind of town that it is and knows what they're going to face if they don't. Because they say, well, we'll just sleep in the square. He says, no, you come to my house. It might just be hospitality, but it may be familiarity with what they might face. And sure enough, what happens is the men of the city come and basically want to take these new men who have come in and rape them. And Lot, it goes out and tries to keep them off. There is people debate, I'm not going to enter into that debate here, about whether he was right or wrong in offering his daughters to the crowd instead of the angels. But clearly, either he understands that they're angels, or at least he knows that they are visitors in his house under his protection. And here they're going to be attacked by the town. So there's clearly something right about where Lot is coming from. He appeals to the crowd not to do this thing, this terrible thing, to the visitors who have come. Lot's kind of a mixed bag too, though. It's interesting that he clearly does ultimately believe the angels and the message that they have proclaimed. He goes and tries to convince others in his family, his sons-in-law, to go along, and they think he's just kidding. I mean, God's going to wipe out the city. It's interesting, though, when it comes time to go, Lot hesitates, it says, and the angels grab him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand and drag him out of the city. So he trusted them, but when it came right down to it, he wasn't like on fire with trust here. It was kind of like, oh, this is weird. And okay, we'll just grab you and take you out. And then, of course, he also has an infamous story about getting drunk after the main event here. His daughters get him drunk and sleep with him. So, you know, this is a family with problems. This is a lot. I don't know, have we had a reality show about that yet? Probably we have. Okay, so this is why Tony always said that Lot was his hero, because Lot is clearly a sinner, and yet he is described by Peter here as a righteous man, okay? And it's that idea that you can be messed up and still be a righteous man, I think, that we should respond to. He was righteous in the sense that he was faithful in following God. Even living among the sinful degradation of Sodom, he did not stop following God or pursuing the goodness that God had called him to. Peter speaks of Lot's soul being tormented day by day because of the sinfulness of his neighbors. This is not spelled out in the story. We don't see that described exactly, but it seems like a legitimate extrapolation. Having lived in Sodom so long, he certainly knows his neighbors. Clearly, he is not like them. We can see that from the incident with the angels. He clearly understands the people of his city. He knows what those men are there to do. He's appalled at what they want to do and tries to stop them. So I think the story makes clear that Lot is a different kind of guy in the midst of a very evil situation. Presumably the horror that he shows on this occasion would tell us how he responded the rest of the time. But there's nothing specific there that says so. Okay, so I think both Lot and Noah deserve Peter's description of them as righteous. In both the story of Noah and the story of Lot, we see God preserving his people through trial. The world was tried and found wanting, but God preserved Noah in his faithfulness. Sodom and Gomorrah were tried and found wanting, but God preserved Lot in his faithfulness. So this look back at the past, then, that Peter has done, supports the admonition that he's been making to his readers. There are these two kinds of people in the world. There are those to whom God is imparting his very nature so that they might arrive at life and godliness, and there are those who are locked into their rebellion against God, and their destiny is judgment and destruction. Looking at how God preserved Noah and Lot in the midst of great evil should be encouraging to us. This is what God can do for you, readers, Peter is saying, as you respond to the pressures that you face from the false teachers. And look at how God did not fail, ultimately, to judge those who rebel against him. That, too, is what God has promised to do. A day of judgment is coming, and the false teachers and those who listen to them will be swept away. So, God can preserve you. God will judge those who have turned against him. So, don't listen to the false teachers, because they're not taking you anywhere you want to go. You don't want to go with them where they're going. This is reality. We look back at these events in the past, and it tells us this is, in fact, what's going on. There is a God like that. He is going to do this thing. He is going to rescue his people. He is going to destroy his enemies. That's the way it's going to be. So then, what are you going to do in response to that? That's what Peter's saying. He concludes that by saying, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly out of trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its defiling desires and despise authority. Okay, now, Peter wouldn't have to have picked on these particular qualities here, but I think it's fairly clear why he does in this context. These are the qualities that he has been describing as characteristic of the false teachers. They are licentious and lawless. They want to do what they want to do, and they don't want to submit to what God would have them do. Now, if he were writing against self-righteous Pharisees, then he might describe the problem very differently. But Peter is highlighting the problem that he thinks his readers are encountering and will encounter with the false teachers. This is licentiousness, self-indulgence under the umbrella of being a believer. That's the problem that he thinks that he's seeing out there, and so that's why he speaks of it in this way. Peter says that they indulge the flesh in its defiling desires. And I should say something about this, I think, because sometimes we Christians get a bad rap when it comes to issues of desire, the flesh in the sense of the body and its various desires. We have the reputation of believing that all desire is bad, and submitting to any desire is bad. Wanting something and going after something that gives pleasure or satisfaction, we sometimes have the reputation as saying that a godly person wouldn't do that. And, you know, there have been those places in history that have led to that kind of conclusion. I've talked before about Augustine, who I admire in many ways, but because of he had a very licentious background, who had indulged himself in immorality, sexual immorality, a lot before his conversion, he came to have a very low view of sexuality. And I'm sure I've said before, but there's this one spot in one of his writings where he talks about how the ancients, okay, so they may have had polygamy, so they might have had more than one wife, but they were better than many of you, because at least when they did their duty and they had sex with their wife, they didn't enjoy it. Whereas you guys are having sex with your wives because you want to. What kind of a perverse, immoral person are you? That was Augustine. And he, unfortunately, has colored how we are perceived by the world, I think. And it might sound like Peter is saying something like that here with a phrase like defiling desires, implying that the very desires themselves defile us, that having those desires is somehow defiling. But I don't think that's what he means. We need to see that phrase working closely with the next one where he speaks about them despising authority. That is, they do not want to submit to the sovereignty, the domain, the rule of God. They do not want to submit and do what their master would have them do. So this, I think, is the picture that Peter has. He means by defiling desires, he means indulging those desires that would indeed defile us. There are times when doing what you want is a defiling act. Not always, but sometimes it is. So, God, I think, and well, it's obvious, the Bible talks about this all the time. God created us to have many and various desires. Our bodies are a source of many pleasures and pains, and we use these sensations to figure out how to live our lives. I mean, that's, we take in the information that our senses give us of in all sorts of ways to decide what we're going to do with our lives. We get hungry, we have a desire for food, and we eat. We desire intimacy and children, and so we marry. I mean, it is that desire for those things that leads people to marry. When something hurts, that sensory information, we want to find a way to eliminate the problem. It's healthy because pain is a signal that there's something wrong. It is not pursuing what we want and acting on what we want that is bad. We are defiled and degraded by our desires when we will not control them, when we will not say no when we ought to say no. God has given us bodies, but we must choose how to use them. And most importantly, we must decide whether we will control our appetites in obedience to God's will. We have the example of Jesus telling us about marriage. What sort of a thing is marriage between man and woman? He goes back to Genesis, to creation, and says, this is the way God made it. This is the way he made things to be, which implies that we have this question that we face. If God made it to be like this, am I going to submit to that, or am I going to let my desires take and turn it into something else? I mean, I don't think I'm talking about anything that you don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, we all recognize the way desire can drive us to go places where God would not have us go in all sorts of ways. So the problem with the false teachers is not that they have desires. Every human being has desires. The problem with the false teachers is not that they act on those desires, because every human being acts on his or her desires, and many times it's appropriate and right. God gave us those desires to be acted on. That's not a problem. The problem with the false teachers is that they will not admit that God has set limits, that he has said, this is the way I want you to conduct yourself. This is the way I want you to use the desires that you have. The false teachers are dangerous not because they indulge the body, as if somehow bodily sins were the worst, because I don't think that's true. I don't think the Bible indicates that that's true. They are dangerous because they teach us to ignore God as we decide how to behave. In this case, the bodily desires are ruling them. It's what they want more than they want to follow God. And that's how they're dangerous. Not because they're urging us to do things with our bodies as if doing something with your body is inherently evil. What's dangerous about them is that they are saying, hey, we're believers, we're with you, we're in this with you, but we will not submit to limits on how we use our desires. Their sensuality is a symptom of their refusal to bow to God's authority, and that's why they're dangerous. It's not that sensuality is such a terrible thing. In the appropriate situation, sensuality is great. But sensuality unchecked, sensuality with no willingness to say no, indicates an unwillingness to bow to God. And that's a serious spiritual situation that will ultimately lead to destruction. We have to bow the knee to God. We have to start at least with that place that says to God, you have the right to tell me what to do. Now, all of us struggle. None of us do it perfectly. None of us even get close to doing it perfectly. But we have to start at that place where we bow the knee and said, you have the right to tell me what you made me for and how you want me to use what you gave me. Okay, so I'll finish up here. I don't know how all this talk about judgment and so forth sits with you. I actually don't know how it sits with you as I'm thinking about this. Maybe some of you have been used to thinking this way for a long time, and this is no big deal. Yeah. Judgment, yeah, that's God. That's what he's going to do. Maybe it makes you uncomfortable to talk about this. in this way. It should make us uncomfortable in a sense. I mean, we're talking about, we all intellectually, theoretically embrace the idea that death is coming, but we're talking about the death that's worse than death. We're talking about my creator taking and saying, no, life is not yours. You are going on the trash heap. I think if we're going to take the Bible seriously at all, we have to come to terms with this idea of judgment. I don't see any way of getting around it. Not that I'm trying to get around it, but it's there from beginning to end. Sometimes people talk about the Bible having two pictures of God. I know we've talked about this before, but I'm sure you've encountered this, the idea that the Old Testament God is a God of wrath and judgment, and the New Testament God is a God and love of love and mercy. Well, this is in the New Testament that we just read here. I might remind you of that. The fact is that the God of the Old Testament is a God of both judgment and mercy, and it's easy to find plenty of both in the Old Testament. And the God of the New Testament is a God of both judgment and mercy. Jesus talks about God's judgment quite a bit, and all the other apostles do. The idea of God's judgment is one of the distinctives of a biblical view of God. You know, mankind has had various pictures of God throughout history. We have seen God as a clockmaker who wound up the universe and then just sort of left and left us to sort out what to do with it. We've seen God as a benevolent grandfather who just wants to do nice things for us. We have seen God as an impersonal force that animates the universe. We've seen God as a fiction, an untrue story that ignorant people tell themselves. But the biblical view of God very much emphasizes several things, but one of the things that it emphasizes about him is that he is holy. He is our creator. He is righteous and good. We owe him our gratitude. We owe him our obedience. And yet, we have turned away from him in big ways and in small ways. And unless something is done, we will fall under his judgment. You know, the gospel is good news. But the good news, as I have often said, is good because it is a response to the bad news. The fact is that there is a God, and you are going to stand before him, and your eternal destiny is in his hands. That's what the Bible is saying. He is merciful. He lovingly reaches out and rescues us from the fire, not because we deserve it, because of the mercy that he's shown in Christ. But we can't understand the Bible if we don't come face to face with the reality of judgment. And I don't know if you've encountered this, but I have, you know, I've known people in my life that reject Christianity precisely because of this element of judgment. Okay, I can buy the idea that there's a God. I like Jesus. You know, he goes around and says to love your neighbor and all this stuff. You know, that's great. But this judgment stuff, that's ugly. Why would you follow a God who is condemning people all the time? I've encountered people who feel like our message is unattractive and basically untenable because of this element of judgment. Maybe that's why we, like I was saying, maybe that's why we downplayed it at times, and I feel like it was downplayed when I became a Christian, the idea that that's not something you really talk about a lot. But I think it's clear that this is what Peter believes, then this is what they need to keep in mind. This is the picture that they need to get in their heads so that they have a clear perspective on their lives and the choices that they face. He's sounding a message of both warning and encouragement. Yes, God will rescue his people. This is a great truth and a great encouragement, but there is only one other alternative. If you are not rescued, then you will perish. And that's why the false teachers are so dangerous. That's why he's warning about them. They talk about God. They still portray themselves as on the same path as other believers. But they live in such a way that they deny that they might fall under the judgment of God. And they deny that God can set any limits on what they're going to do in their lives. They don't want to say no to themselves. And so they somehow or another deny that God wants them to say no to themselves. Somehow, it's okay for me to pursue whatever I want. And it is that unwillingness to look God in the eye and say, what do you want from me, that is so dangerous for these people who are calling themselves believers. So Peter wants to warn his readers that there are only two paths you can take. We can be washed away in a judgment like the flood, or by the grace of God, we can be in the boat with Noah. We can perish in the fire like Sodom and Gomorrah, or God can graciously take us by the hand and pull us out of the fire into life. And those are the only two alternatives, and that's why Peter's language is so harsh, because he wants to confront his readers with the choice that they have to make. Don't listen to those who are unwilling to submit to the will of God. Their end is destruction, and you do not want to share it with them. Okay, so we have a few minutes for any questions or comments you might have.
Thanks a lot, Ron. Let's see, I'm just kind of wanting to take big picture, grasp the whole concept type of thing here. So given all have sinned, fall short of the glory of God, righteous and unrighteous. The unrighteous would say, oh yeah, I'm doing this sort of stuff. Well, I'm totally free from guilt. I'm just fine and just encourage other people to do it. Whereas the righteous would say about their sin of, oh, expletive, 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 I did it again. Oh, God, this is stuff that really deserves condemnation. I'm surprised that you haven't torched me already. Have mercy on me. And so it would appear that those who with that concept of who are the righteous, who really want to do good but sing the Romans 7 blues, are in this life kind of unhappy, whereas the unrighteous are just la-di-da, fine, and doing whatever they do, and then with the judgment, we'll see who's really happy at the end. So am I encapsulating this? Am I missing anything?
Yes, I think that's, I like that statement. I think it's a fair statement. And being a miserable sinner myself, I'm really big on let's bring up the whole Romans 7 stuff and everything. I mean, that's all great. Now, I do want to say on the other side that this kind of righteousness that we're talking about in these situations, I mean, the fact is we don't find Lot the next day saying, oh, rats, I raped some angels again. I mean, he looked at this situation and said, what are you doing? And recoiled from it and tried to rescue them from it. He had a commitment to what was right that led him to actually do at least partially the right thing in that situation. So I don't want to leave us with the impression that we have nothing but failure, and the only thing that marks us as belonging to God is that we recognize that we have failed and admit that we have failed, although that is a large part of it, because we do fail. And that willingness to see myself as God sees me and to recognize my need for God's mercy is a huge part of what it means to be a believer. But it does translate itself into, as I come to see what it is that God is calling me to, I am trying to go that way. And sometimes I get there. I mean, it not in the sense of, wow, look how great I am, so now God should send me to heaven because I'm great, but because I have set my heart on being God's person. So that has an impact on the way I do things. But yes, yes, I do agree. There's a lot of groaning that happens for the people of God that those who just blow God off don't do, because it isn't till you start fighting with yourself that you realize what a miserable situation you're in. If you don't enter the fight at all, then, hey, nothing to worry about.
Kind of almost like the sort of acts of righteousness are temporary lapses of rebellion.
Yeah, well, I should have more of those lapses.
The word temptation that they were rescued from, is that the same word that's used in the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation? Is that the kind of thing that we're praying to be rescued from?
Yes. But I would argue that the word is used in different contexts, sometimes more with the sense of temptation. Let me make this distinction. There is temptation, which kind of means the enticement to sin. You know, Satan is tempting Jesus in the wilderness. In James, when it says that God doesn't tempt anyone, it's this word group that we're talking about here. But James also talks about God testing Abraham, and it's the same word. So God doesn't, is it peirazo? Is that the word? I think that's the word. God doesn't peirazo, but he peirazos. And the idea is, in our translation, he doesn't tempt, he tests. I am not to picture myself as hopelessly trying to hold out against the forces of God trying to entice me to sin, but rather God puts us in situations where they are trials. They test. We discover what kinds of people we are in the midst of those. And that same word can be used in both ways. So in these kinds of contexts, sometimes you have to try to sort out which are we talking about. When it says God doesn't tempt, it's clearly on the side of enticement that we're talking about. In this context, I think he means something more than just God rescues them from enticement. It's in this situation where the fundamental commitments of the heart are sorting themselves out, and all of these people are showing themselves to be set against God. Noah and Lot prevail. They persevere. They show themselves to be something else. And so it's a trial. It's kind of like you're in the pressure cooker. Peter, in 1 Peter, uses the analogy of purifying gold in the fire and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it is the same word, but we still face the question in each context, does he mean, is it better translated tempt or test?
Well, it seems like in the Lord's Prayer, it could be that same meaning. I mean, that deeper, not just temptations from Satan, but, you know, I want to be pulled out of the fire. I want to...
Right, right. The question is, in the Lord's Prayer, with that, lead us not into temptation. Mm,
not God doing it, yeah.
Yeah, when we're praying to God in that circumstance.
Okay,
go ahead.
But then in the Old Testament, the thing that brought me to Reformation in the first place was this question.
Uh-huh.
In the Old Testament, when David numbered the people, and the book of Samuel, I think it was, says that Satan got him to do it.
Right.
And in Chronicles, it said God did it.
Right. Right.
Okay,
right.
That was the whole, that
right.
was my whole big question.
Right.
So it seems like kind of the same thing here. But is it not?
Well.
I know, this is a bigger question.
No, it was. It's a very important question, and it's a good question. See, I think it depends on where you're looking at God's activity. Let's use Jack's language of God transcendently being responsible for everything in the world. Okay, so yes, you know, God brings the light and the darkness and, you know, all of those kinds of things that it says. But that's God's sovereign control of the whole story that he is telling. But then we talk about, like, the Spirit of God intervening in the world or something. Now we're talking about God actively entering into this story. And what is he doing? When he enters into the story, what is he doing? And I think that's the place where we would say, when he enters into that story, what he does is he doesn't tempt, but he does test. That is, I don't have God standing in front of me saying, come on, Ron, try do this evil thing. I live in the world that he made, but when he encounters me in the world, he is coming at me for my good. When I'm praying to God, do not lead us into temptation, I think what he has in mind is the idea of being led into temptation in the sense of being overcome with the temptation, not just like to do a little evil here and there, but the fundamental temptation to just to turn away from God, that what I am praying for is that you who are leading my life, do not lead me to the place where I am destroyed by temptation, where evil ends up destroying me. Deliver me from evil instead. So it's really a prayer for salvation in a sense. Not just I would like to be a little better person, but do not let the evil one destroy me through my own you know, being sucked in to that stuff. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's kind of how I see that. So that question that you're asking, yeah, it all depends where are you looking at it. When James says something like God does not tempt anyone, what he's saying is I can't do the, oh, God made me do it thing. That doesn't work. On another level, on the transcendent level of how everything is put together, we can talk about that. But if we're talking about me now facing the choices that I have and the things that are coming at me in the world, God has never come at me in the world and pushed me to make me sin. He has called me out not to and has empowered me. He has reached in through his spirit to lead me away from that stuff. I know those are very hard things.
Did you do a word study on the word lawless? Because we read a lot about we're no longer under law, but under grace. So the word lawless is getting at a different point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's your take on that word, and why is it used that way?
Well, there are two different words that are used for lawless in this passage. I'm trying to remember. As I would see the ways it was used, yeah, the idea is not, oh, I'm a person whose conscience is free because I have been freed from the condemnation of having to keep the law. It is rather, like I said, it is that unwillingness to recognize that God has a way that he wants me to go and that I should submit to that. I mean, we all wrestle with that as Christians, the idea of the grace of God, that we are forgiven for our sin. You know, Paul explores this question of, does the fact that I have been forgiven of my sin become then an incentive somehow to continue to sin? Because maybe I'm making God look better, or maybe it's just, hey, I'm free, I can do what I want. But that's the thing that Peter has been talking about as well, and Paul does the same thing in Romans, I would say, is the very nature of our salvation is that we recognize that sin is a destroyer, that being a sinner has never done me any good, that sin is a corrosive force in my life and in human interaction, and God was rightly going to condemn me for it. So there is no incentive to pursue it. I'm forgiven for being a sinner, but I can't really claim to believe the gospel and be following God as a genuine believer, but yet at the same time embrace sin as a good that I want to pursue in my life. I'm a sinner, and I wrestle with the fact that I'm a sinner, and sometimes I don't wrestle very hard. But I acknowledge and I see the nature of the problem. So the lawless person in this situation is the person who will not acknowledge those limits really apply to them. I don't want to submit to those limits. I don't want there to be those limits. I will not say no to myself. That's the lawless person. The person who is not under law is the person who gratefully recognizes that God has forgiven us for not keeping his moral standard. But that person still wants to pursue goodness because he believes God when he says that that is the whole point of this thing and goodness is where life is to be found. Okay, so ran out of time there, and we'll pick this up next week.